everything except the energy code and the energy code itself. And the reason I'm making this distinction is because through this code adoption, while we're titling it the 2025.
The Independent Audit Committee was established by charter and receives audit reports and other information from the Denver Audit Office. The committee strives to bring greater clarity, transparency, and accountability to Denver's city government and its residents. It is also responsible for commissioning an annual audit of the city's annual comprehensive financial report. This committee is chaired by Auditor Timothy M. O'Brien.
Would you take the roll?
Jack Blumenthal.
Here.
Maureen Knapp.
Here.
Ed Schultz.
Here.
Frank Groh.
Here.
Tim O'Brien.
Here. Next item is approval of the April meeting minutes. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second. Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, the minutes are approved. Next item we have is a report briefing on organizational culture. I'd like to welcome LaTanya from the mayor's office, at least for a little while longer. Is that right?
Indeed. Good morning, everyone.
Carla Anthony from Human Resources, Gretchen Hollera from Arts and Venues, and Jolyn Clark from Parks and Recreation. Doris, would you like to introduce yourself and the team and
yes.
Get started?
Of course. Good morning, Auditor and Committee members. My name is Cara Sepstein, and I was the manager on the organizational culture audit that we're presenting this morning. I am joined at the table by Senior Auditors Shannon Scheich, Danny Plood, and Sada El-Mukili, and Associate Auditor Summer Sargent. Isabel Pupa, lead auditor, also worked on the project before the meeting. Before we get started, I'd also like to thank the leaders and staff in the Mayor's Office, Office of Human Resources, Denver Arts and Venues, and Denver Parks and Recreation, who worked with us on this audit. It was truly a pleasure to work with all of you. Thank you also to department leaders for encouraging your staff to meet with us for our focus groups and to respond to our survey. And we want to finally thank the 120 staff from all levels of each agency who met with us to share their thoughts. Their willingness to participate demonstrated courage to talk about things both positive and challenging, and also a commitment to the organization and the city.
So before we get started, would any Gretchen, Dolan, Carla, LaTanya, would you have any opening remarks that you'd like to make at this time? Okay, you don't have to, but.
Not about the audit, but just to reiterate the thanks to the team who showed up in person to meet with our staff, and I think that meant a lot to our team at Arts and Venues.
Thank you.
I narrowly escaped giving you all COVID.
Did not give us COVID.
Okay. As outlined starting on page one of the report, organizational culture is defined as the invisible belief systems, values, norms, and preferences of the individuals that form an organization. It is made up of what is said, such as an organization's vision or code of ethics, and what is done, including people's behaviors and attitudes. Ideally, the actual culture and preferred culture are aligned. Strong or positive organizational culture is one where open communication exists and trust. Staff feel valued and heard. Additionally, a strong culture supports both individual and organizational growth. Conversely, toxic culture can stem from an unethical tone at the top and poorly defined organizational values. There's typically less teamwork and collaboration, and further, there may be a lack of honesty, transparency, and accountability. Organizational culture can greatly impact an organization and is critical in shaping its success or failure. Toxic organizational culture has been shown to be a root cause for many serious workplace issues, including high turnover and unethical behavior such as fraud. It also can cause staff to be less engaged and have poor morale. Culture has been shown to be 10 times more likely to be a predictor of staff leaving their jobs over compensation. And government staff actually tend to prioritize culture and organizational values over salary. Further, turnover is costly to organizations. According to the Office of Human Resources, the city spends an average of $40,000 for each instance of staff turnover. As shown on page 2, we selected 4 agencies to include in our audit based on their role within the city, whether they were scheduled for any other audits, and our review of 2022 engagement survey results and turnover data from 2022 through 2024. Because the actions of city leaders and their tone can impact staff behavior and organizational culture, we included the mayor's office. Mayor Mike Johnston was sworn into office July 2023, bringing a new administration as well as new goals. Aside from influencing citywide culture, the office has its own, set by its roughly 43 staff. The Office of Human Resources is at the center of city operations and partners with agencies and leaders to drive city functions and administer career service roles. It also administers the Employee Engagement Survey, reviews the results of each agency, and assists agencies in developing action plans based on the results. Denver Arts and Venues manages, maintains, and programs the city's public event venues and provides cultural programs. And Denver Parks and Recreation services the Denver community by providing a broad range of programs, services, facilities, and park amenities. While we did not analyze generational shifts or data or the impact of COVID-19 as part of our audit, it's important to note that both should be considered when looking at culture. Generational shifts play an impact on organizational culture because there are different generations working side by side with different preferences, communication styles, and experiences. Each generation may also value perks and appreciation differently as well. Research shows that culture is more important to some younger generations as well, such as millennials. The pandemic also significantly reshaped organizational culture by emphasizing the importance of flexibility and digital communication tools. Staff in the city have alternated between working 100% remotely to coming to the office a set number of days per week. The pandemic has also shifted what staff value in a leader. Initially, staff were looking for more direction during a time of uncertainty, whereas now there's a focus on building compassion, stability, and trust from agency leaders. Our audit had 4 objectives. The first was to determine the extent the City and County of Denver and each agency defined and communicated goals, strategies, and expectations related to culture. Next, we analyzed if agencies effectively used organizational culture data and information to make decisions. We also analyzed whether staff's perception of culture aligned with agency leaders' goals and understanding. And finally, we evaluated whether employee engagement and development opportunities are effective at promoting a positive and equitable organizational culture. As part of our review, we looked at the results from the 2022 Employee Engagement Survey, as well as from the Organizational Culture Assessment Instrument Survey that we distributed as part of our audit. We also conducted focus groups with staff at various levels and leveraged a sentiment analysis to be able to quantify the qualitative information that we gathered in those groups. We reviewed documentation and data for the period of July 2021 through September 2024. And I would like to now open the floor for any questions or comments.
Questions, comments? Let's continue.
All right, thank you. Shannon will cover finding one.
Thank you, Karis. Finding 1, beginning on page 6 of the report, says organizational culture in each agency needs improvement. This finding has 3 sub-findings. Before I present sub-finding 1, we'd like to acknowledge the work these agencies have done to better understand and address potential internal cultural issues. Some agencies have used tools, including internal surveys and interviews with staff, to understand culture and engagement and to identify what could be done better. Additionally, some staff in each agency noticed improvements in culture under their new senior leaders. Staff in all agencies said they volunteered for our focus groups because they care about their agency's mission, and the city. We commend these agencies and their staff for their continued commitment to providing quality services and making the city and county of Denver a great place to work. Moving on to subfinding 1, beginning on page 6 of the report, we found the culture staff want and what we think they have do not match. The Office of Human Resources defines employee engagement as a measure of employees' passion for their work and says it reflects employees' commitment and connection to their organization and its goals. Unlike employee satisfaction, employee engagement can predict employees' job performance and productivity, and it can also be an indicator of employees' willingness to stay with an organization. As discussed on page 6 of the report, the city's turnover rate nearly doubled from 11% to 20% from 2020 to 2022, before dropping to 16% in 2023. Human resources said turnover rates in 2022 cost the city an average of roughly $38,000 per lost employee, but this number is now closer to $40,000 for each employee. To help address turnover rates, Human Resources administers a citywide employee engagement survey every 2 years to try and understand where employees stand in their engagement and to identify where agencies should focus their efforts to increase it. While staff typically take the survey in the spring, the 2024 engagement survey was delayed until December to get a better picture of employee engagement under the new mayoral administration. In early 2024, the mayor's office set a goal of increasing employee engagement citywide by 5% by December 31st, 2024. Progress toward this goal would be measured using the results of the 2024 employee engagement survey. The office also created a team called the Employee Engagement Tiger Team to help agencies work toward this goal. As part of its efforts, the Tiger Team requested each city agency create and submit action plans to address issues identified in the 2022 engagement survey and to provide monthly updates on engagement efforts. Though the city prioritized improving employee engagement in 2024, our focus groups with staff at each agency revealed that some employees did not feel their leaders meaningfully addressed the 2022 survey results. As discussed on page 8 of the report, some staff said agency leaders started addressing the results, but that leaders ultimately did not share what actions they took or any progress they had made in improving low-scoring survey areas. We reviewed communication sent from agency leaders to staff regarding engagement initiatives and found that some explained those initiatives were created in response to the 2022 survey, while others did not. Further, the mayor's office did not ask agencies to create and submit action plans until there was a new mayoral administration and nearly 2 years after the 2022 survey was administered. The office asked agencies to provide updates on their engagement efforts only 2 months before the 2024 engagement survey was sent to city employees. According to what staff said in our focus group sessions and from our review of agencies' internal survey data, some low-scoring areas from the 2022 engagement survey still persist. Table 2 on page 10 of the report shows the three lowest-scoring areas in the 2022 survey for the Mayor's Office, Human Resources, Arts and Venues, and Parks and Recreation. While there are some limitations to how agencies can address specific engagement survey items like pay, most other survey items are related to issues that are within agencies' control, like improving internal communications, promoting ethics and diversity in its workforce, and supporting staff in their career development. Human Resources meets with agencies to discuss employee engagement survey results and identifies areas of concern, and the office encourages agencies to develop action items to address these areas. But the city has no formal requirements for agencies to act on engagement survey results and to make improvements. Furthermore, neither the Mayor's Office nor Human Resources has formal plans for tracking and using data related to the 2024 Employee Engagement Survey and agencies' engagement efforts. As discussed on page 13 of the report, we also identified some issues with how the Employee Engagement Survey assesses agencies' culture. For instance, the engagement survey does not ask any questions about employees' preferred workplace culture, nor does it allow staff to provide open-ended responses to any of the questions or prompts. Additionally, the guidance Human Resources provided agencies to address their survey results did not capture the nuances that may exist with individual teams, divisions, or other work groups within an agency. It only provided general themes for the agency as a whole. In addition to reviewing the 2022 engagement survey results, we sent a survey called the Organizational Culture Assessment Instrument to all staff in all four agencies. Response rates for each agency are discussed on page 15 of the report. The survey tool is used to assess workplace culture along four culture types: the dynamic and pioneering create culture, the collective people-oriented collaborate culture, the structured and process-oriented control culture, and the aggressive results-oriented compete culture. As discussed in pages 17 to 18 of the report, the dominant culture in the mayor's office, or the culture that staff feel is most prominent, is the compete culture. Staff's desire for change is greatest for this culture type, meaning they would like the agency to focus considerably less on results. The dominant culture type in the Office of Human Resources, Denver Arts and Venues, and Denver Parks and Recreation is the control culture. Staff in all three agencies indicated they prefer less of a focus on this culture type, meaning they would like their agencies to focus less on structure, procedures, and efficiency. Overall, staff in each agency expressed a desire for their culture to be more collaborative and focused on its people. These feelings were also shared during focus groups when some staff said their culture is fast-paced and results-driven, which means sometimes staff said they experienced or witnessed blame for errors, were asked to do more to meet goals with less resources, and the focus is more on satisfying the needs of external clients and the public rather than the agency's own staff. Some staff also said across-agency communications could be better to minimize work silos. While the mayor had a goal of increasing employee engagement by 5% by the end of 2024, the mayor's office does not have formal documented goals related to culture or engagement outside this overarching goal. The other three agencies have their own goals related to culture and engagement, but they're generally informal or high level and lacking actionable details. Additionally, some agencies have used tools such as internal surveys to assess engagement and culture, while others did not. Therefore, we have five recommendations for this subfinding, beginning on page 21 of the report. I'll read all five before pausing for questions or comments from the agencies or committee members. Recommendation 1.1 says the mayor's office should work with the Office of Human Resources to ensure all city agencies develop and act on plans to address the lowest scoring areas in the survey. Recommendation 1.2 says the mayor's office and the Office of Human Resources should assess the employee engagement survey to ensure it appropriately captures information on culture that will be helpful for city agencies. Both the mayor's office and human resources agreed with these recommendations with implementation dates between May 30th, 2025 through March 27th, 2026. Recommendation 1.3 says, using input from staff at all levels and leading practices, leaders in all four agencies should develop, document, and communicate culture strategies, goals, and objectives. All four agencies agreed with this recommendation with implementation dates between May 30th, 2025 through December 31st, 2025. Recommendation 1.4 says leaders in all four agencies should develop and document a plan to assess current and preferred organizational culture. Lastly, recommendation 1.5 says leaders in all four agencies should develop and document policies and procedures for assessing culture. All four agencies agreed with these recommendations, implementation dates between July 25th, 2025 through December 31st, 2025. I'll now pause to allow for any questions or comments from the audit committee or agency representatives.
Anything the departments would like to add? We all agree, and that's great. Questions from the committee?
Well, I've got one question, and this is a really tough thing. You have a mayor who's been elected, and you have the citizens out there who not only vote, but they pay taxes and they do what it is. And so if the employees want to do something different, then the electorate would like to have, you're going to have a real schism in there. And so the question is, who comes first, the customers or the employees, in terms of where they're going? Could any of you share how you see that and what can be done about it, if anything? I mean, there's really a conflict there that makes it very difficult for everybody, especially you guys, from my perspective, unless I'm missing something.
Anyone like to take a shot at that?
I can start.
Please.
And we appreciate the work of the audit. It gives us a path forward with a new administration and new leadership in the agency, myself and my deputy director, Jen Morris, who's here today. In our conversations with staff and what we find through our hiring and our ongoing management of employees, a really mission-driven response at arts and venues. And so we see alignment between what the community wants and what our team wants, which is the delivery of excellent and accessible programming at our venues. So I have not seen misalignment there at this point.
And I'll just add, I think there is a ton of alignment between what our employees want to deliver, what our residents want, and who they are electing to lead that. For us, the cultural, you know, the culture and this audit was more about the how do we do it and less about the, hey, are we all swimming in the same direction? There's a lot of alignment there. It's about what is the culture and how are we making sure to recognize and appreciate good work and create space where people aren't feeling overworked and overburdened and organize that work and organize the culture around that work. And how do people interact with their supervisors and how do they interact with senior leaders in an organization like Parks and Rec that has 72 different locations where employees show up to work and we're spread out all across the city with 2,500 different employees. How do you create a culture that unifies people in that work more than are we aligned on what the work is? And I think that was really what we're digging into here is how are we aligning in the how and not the what.
I would like to change my answer to be Jolyn's answer.
Done.
And the Office of Human Resources, we serve our internal agencies for the most part, and we strive to exceed their expectations and anticipate their needs while understanding what our constituents are requesting from them. And we try to anticipate that. And it comes down to accountability. We try to hold our folks accountable to make sure that we're meeting those expectations and create an environment where all our employees can succeed as best we can.
I am in agreement with my colleagues here. But what I will share is that I don't exactly see the conflict. I certainly appreciate you raising it because it's one to be raised. But in the mayor's office specifically, we have an outreach team that works very closely with the community, if you will. And so we are very intentional about creating platforms that allow for feedback. Most recently, we have created the Dear Mayor platform. And that is not only for the mayor's office employees, but for employees citywide to be able to provide input. In anonymous input, if you will. And so with the interaction that our employees have with the community, we are fortunate that we feel that we're always, you know, actually obtaining community input. And we're very intentional about going out and hearing from our community as well. And so everything that we do, whenever it comes down to the goals that are established within the agency, the goals that are established citywide, we are very, very clear to ensure that there is a level of inclusivity in those realms. And so it's something that we're mindful of and that we will continue to be mindful of as we move forward.
Thank you. Maureen?
I'd just like to make a comment that it was refreshing to hear that that many of the agencies had, particularly the mayor's office, were goal and achievement driven, and that was a priority. And that if that then is not perceived by the employees as being the most important thing, maybe there just needs to be a little more of the collaborative side to get them to want to do those things. But I'm glad to hear that there's, you know, accountability and goals and mission and a focus on that.
Thank you.
And all within, you know, constrained resources and the potential of less resources coming from Washington, D.C. So it's a difficult environment. Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Should we continue?
Thank you. Now we will present the second subfinding, finding one. Subfinding two, beginning on page 26 of the report, says committees dedicated to employee engagement and culture may not be effective. While not required, all four agencies have committees dedicated to addressing concerns related to employee engagement and culture. However, we found most committees lack formality and structure. Most committees are voluntary, but a few have members who were selected by agency leaders, and some staff were strongly encouraged to participate. We found most committees did not have criteria for membership or a formal selection process. While most committees have members from all divisions within the agency, the Mayor's Office Committee has no members from one of its two divisions. Without representation on the committee, some divisions could have concerns go unheard, may not feel they are contributing to change, or may not receive relevant information in a timely manner.
On page 27 of the report, most committees do not take meeting minutes, document action items, and do not have documented policies and procedures outlining their authority, purpose, or the responsibilities of committee members. Department staff for most agencies said some committees were new and therefore did not have documented policies or procedures outlining their purpose, who should be on them, or how they operate. But without documented policies and procedures, committees may not be effective. Continuing on page 27 of the report, some staff said the effectiveness of committees depends on who is leading them. Others said committees became less effective or dissolved completely when leaders changed or when key people left. Because committees are voluntary, staff may not always have the time to dedicate to committees because of competing work. Committees may not be able to carry on with their responsibilities or meet objectives when key staff leave and committee structure, authority, and responsibilities are not documented. When committees are perceived as ineffective, staff may feel they are not making an impact or feel committees or leaders are insincere. When committees lack support from leaders, they may struggle to make decisions, allocate resources, or gain the necessary authority to carry out goals and action items. We have two recommendations for this subfinding, beginning on page 28 of the report. Recommendation 1.6 says leaders in each agency should determine and document whether a committee is needed to help achieve employee engagement and culture objectives and goals. Recommendation 1.7 says leaders in each agency should document policies and procedures to ensure clarity, transparency, and purpose of each committee. All four agencies agreed with these recommendations with implementation dates between July 31st, 2025 and December 31st, 2025. I'll now pause to allow for any questions or comments from the audit committee or agency representatives.
Any additional comments from the departments? Questions from the committee? Okay, let's continue.
Thank you. Now Sada will present subfinding 3.
Thank you, Danny. Subfinding 3, beginning on page 30 of the report, says staff development opportunities and employee recognition may not be equitable. As discussed on page 30 of the report, the city requires employees to take trainings and set performance goals each year. All four agencies provide training and development opportunities to some staff beyond the city's requirements. Leaders in most agencies said they rely on supervisors to recommend trainings or staff to request additional trainings, and they did not have policies or procedures for this process. Staff said development opportunities depended on their supervisor. Some staff said there was no transparency or criteria for how staff were selected for opportunities, and some were unsure how opportunities worked. As shown in figure 7, page 31 of the report, managers and staff in each agency felt their access to training opportunities was only slightly positive. We reviewed documentation for staff in all four agencies who participated in development and training opportunities from July 1st, 2021 through September 30th, 2024. We only included trainings that were not required by the city or agency. As shown in Table 3 on page 32, at least one staff member from each agency participated in a development opportunity or training. All four agencies recognize and reward staff for their performance. For example, agency leaders provide paid administrative leave or gift cards for exemplary performance. Some agencies also recognize staff at meetings through awards or informal recognition. However, as shown on page 33 of the report, staff in three agencies felt recognition or rewards were inequitable and were based on either employee popularity or if their manager saw value in providing the recognition. Per human resources guidance, agencies must also send the reward information to the city's controller's office each quarter. We found some issues with tracking of data. Specifically, Denver Arts and Venues and Office of Human Resources had not submitted rewards to the controller's office due to staff turnover. We have 7 recommendations for this subfinding, which begins on page 35 of the report. I will read all 7 before pausing for questions or comments from the agencies or committee. Recommendation 1.8 says for training that is not required, such as leadership courses, conferences, etc., leaders in all four agencies should document criteria and the process for selection. Recommendation 1.9 says the leaders in all four agencies should ensure development opportunities are communicated to all staff when identified. Additionally, the criteria for selection should be communicated in advance to staff. All four agencies agreed with these recommendations with implementation dates between July 24th, 2025 through January 31st, 2026. Recommendation 1.10 says the leaders in all four agencies should prioritize staff development opportunities, such as by establishing a development goal as part of the city's annual goal-setting process. Recommendation 1.11 says leaders in all four agencies should ensure recognition opportunities and selection criteria are communicated to all staff when identified. All four agencies agreed with these recommendations with implementation dates between May 31st, 2025 through August 1st, 2025. Recommendation 1.12 says if agencies choose to provide rewards such as the Spot On, leaders in all four agencies should ensure compliance with all requirements in the city's policies for tracking rewards, including gift cards, and submitting documentation to the controller's office. Recommendation 1.13 says leaders in all four agencies should periodically monitor rewards data, including exemplary leave and other awards, to ensure compliance with city rules and that they are being provided fairly and appropriately across agencies. These reviews should be documented. All four agencies agreed with these recommendations with implementation dates between May 31st, 2025 through December 31st, 2025. Finally, recommendation 1.14 says agency leaders, supervisors, and managers in all four agencies should prioritize recognizing staff, either formally or informally, for work well done, such as by establishing it as a goal during the city's annual goal-setting process or for providing training on awards and recognition. All four agencies agreed with the recommendation with implementation dates between August 1st, 2025 through February 28th, 2026. I would like to open the floor for any questions or comments from the agency and committee members.
Comments from the agencies? No. Questions from the committee?
Thank you. And now Summer will present finding two.
Thank you, Sada. Finding two, beginning on page 43 of the report, says staff and all agencies do not know how to or feel comfortable with hearing concerns and providing upward feedback. As seen on page 43 of the report, city agencies operate under career service rules for codes of conduct and for dispute resolution methods. According to the rules, staff are encouraged to address work-related issues with their direct supervisor before approaching a manager, director, appointing authority, or a human resources representative. Staff in all four agencies said that they had many issues related to this process. Some said that they did not know who they should report issues to, while others knew but did not feel comfortable going to that person. This discomfort existed whether the person receiving the report was a human resources representative or their direct supervisor. Staff in all four agencies were also concerned about information remaining confidential, and they feared retaliation for reporting any concerns. When we asked how agency leaders communicate city and agency reporting processes to their staff, most could not provide adequate documentation of such communications. Only one agency provided documentation showing how these city processes are communicated to all staff, and one provided evidence that it was communicated to new staff only. While the city has rules and procedures for code of conduct violations, when agency leaders are not communicating reporting processes, staff may not understand how to report concerns or who to report to. Additionally, agencies risk not fully addressing staff issues, which can impact job satisfaction and employee retention. As seen on page 45 of the report, while some staff in all agencies said that they received consistent feedback from their direct supervisor, others in all four share that they do not receive regular feedback, with some staff only getting feedback from their supervisor during the annual review process. Others said that they felt uncomfortable requesting feedback and would not provide upward feedback. Within the focus groups, managers in all four agencies felt that they have open communication with their teams about any issues that arise. Additionally, we found only two agencies have conducted formal 360 reviews, but that these reviews were limited to certain staff, highlighting the lack of a formal upward feedback process. Also, staff in all four agencies said that there is a lack of psychological safety and they have experienced fear or blame in their work environment, and often did not feel comfortable providing upward feedback for fear of being punished. Without psychological safety, staff are at an increased risk of stress, burnout, and turnover, impacting the overall performance of the agency. According to the Society of Human Resources Management, when managers regularly provide staff with feedback regarding the quality of their work, staff are more likely to understand how to continue performing well in their role and how they can correct behaviors to improve their performance and the quality of their work. We have four recommendations for this finding, which begin on page 46 of the report. I will read all four before opening the floor for questions or comments from the agency's reporting members. Recommendation 2.1 says that agencies should communicate the availability of city and agency-wide reporting systems and resources to staff at all levels regularly. All four agencies agreed to this recommendation with implementation dates between June 17, 2025 through July 31, 2025. Recommendation 2.2 says agency leaders should prioritize developing psychological safety for staff by providing trainings, creating and tracking goals related to psychological safety, and communicating to staff at all levels the importance of feeling comfortable reporting. All four agencies agreed to this recommendation with implementation dates between June 23rd, 2025 through December 31st, 2025. Recommendation 2.3 says agencies should establish clear guidelines for staff check-ins with their direct supervisor, which encourage two-way communication and feedback. Additionally, recommendation 2.4 says agency leaders should identify and implement a process for staff to provide upward feedback without fear of retaliation. All four agencies agreed to these recommendations with implementation dates between May 1st, 2025 through June 30th, 2026. That concludes our presentation. I will now open the floor for questions or comments from the agencies.
Comments from the agencies?
No.
Questions from the committee? All right, we're finished. Thank you.
Thank you. I just would like to share that the audit team has been phenomenal. They've done a very thorough audit and really appreciate the focus on this topic in particular, which has never been audited before. Area of need in this day and time, and even more so as we move forward with everything coming down the pipe with our economic crisis. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Okay, next up is the Climate Protection Fund.
Somebody needs your help, too.
Patrick, would you like to introduce the team, and we'll then ask the department to introduce themselves, and any opening comments would be appropriate.
Sure. Yeah. I'll just start with why is this audit important, right? That's how we always start. So it's important because it's a voter-initiated ordinance here that we're talking about, right? And those are important to our office. We've looked at those recently in the past because that's a tool that gives voters like a direct access to how tax money is spent, right? Contrast that with an indirect approach. You elect somebody, they set policies, procedures, rules, regulations, they dictate how that plays out. But a voter like the one with this climate protection fund, that sales tax, that gives people direct access to how that money is spent. So that's why this is important, right? The recommendations that Sean and his team came up with, it kind of shed some light on maybe we could tighten things up to help that target of what was the intent when voters passed that ordinance. So that's why it's important. I'll turn it over to White Song, and he can introduce the audit team.
Sure. Good morning, everyone. My name is Sean Weissong. I was the manager for this audit we're presenting this morning. Also joined at the table by the rest of my team. We have June Samadi, lead auditor, Dan O'Connor, senior auditor, Frank Jusu, associate auditor, and Natalia Kaplinski, associate auditor. I would also just like to take this time to thank the staff in the Office of Climate Action, Sustainability, and Resiliency. Your help and cooperation was much appreciated throughout this audit. And kind of as Pat said, you know, the fund is very important because, you know, is the city's primary source of revenue to address climate change and meet the city's goals to eliminate greenhouse gas emissions by 2040. So given the importance of the funds, the recommendations we have from this report will help Green Action to administer the fund more effectively. But I'll let you all introduce yourselves.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Babcock. I'm the Executive Director for Denver's Office of Climate Action, Sustainability, and Resiliency. And I'll let my team introduce themselves in just a moment, but wanted to say that we also take this opportunity to review how we're managing the fund very seriously. As you know, it was a voter-approved ballot measure back in November of 2020. This really came out of a desire for our community to see the city continue to lead on climate, even with federal rollbacks of those initiatives, and we're seeing that today as well. So it's more important than ever that we continue to move forward, that we're spending the money as effectively and efficiently as possible, and having the impact that the voters intended when they passed this ordinance. So thank you again for your work, and we're happy to discuss the findings today.
Hi everyone, Jonathan Rogers, call me Johnny. I'm the acting deputy executive director in the climate office, and also appreciate, you know, your help and recommendations as we've been maturing as an organization. I think a lot of steps that we've been taking, we're already moving in those directions, and is helping to reinforce and motivate us to ensure that we're following through as stewards of this important resource.
Good morning everybody, I'm Tim Strack. I'm the director of finance and administration. It's a pleasure to meet you all in person. Really enjoyed working with your team, and we're ready to make some improvements. So.
Okay, let's begin.
As discussed on page one of the report, the Climate Protection Fund was created in November 2020 when Denver residents voted for the 0.25% sales tax increase to develop and implement programs to eliminate greenhouse gas emissions, air pollution, adapt to climate change, and create new jobs for Denver residents. The city also created the Office of Climate Action, Sustainability, and Resiliency in city ordinance to manage the fund. The office started with just 11 staff members in 2020, which increased to 66 staff by the end of 2024. Continuing on pages 1 and 2 of the report, the Climate Protection Fund has 7 allowable uses for fund allocation, which are job creation in renewable and clean energy for people with low income and limited access to services, clean transportation services and programs, investments in renewable energy technology, environmental and climate justice programs based on neighborhood needs, climate adaptation and resiliency programs for vulnerable communities, upgrades for energy efficient buildings and homes, and finally, administrative costs used to manage the fund that cannot exceed 8% of the fund's revenue each year. As shown in Figure 1 on page 3 of the report, the office created allowable use teams to help develop and implement policies and procedures for climate change. The Climate Protection Fund's budget is allocated by allowable use categories, which the energy efficient buildings allowable use receiving the largest percentage of funds at 25%. The Climate Protection Fund has generated over $40 million a year from the 0.25% sales tax. The fund can accumulate unused money each year and remain available for spending on allowable uses in future years. As shown in Figure 2, the Climate Protection Fund collected about $41.6 million in 2021, increasing to about $50.5 million in 2024. Since 2021, the fund has also paid about $103.4 million to support efforts to mitigate climate change, with expenses increasing from about $1.6 million in 2021 to $44.1 million in 2024. In addition, there is the Climate Protection Capital Projects Fund to fund climate-related capital projects. The Climate Protection Fund and Capital Projects Fund have provided funding for 114 contracts with vendors and consultants to help address climate change. Project managers are responsible for monitoring vendor performance and invoices. The Finance and Administration Division is responsible for performing a secondary review of vendor invoices to ensure compliance with project terms. Our audit objective was to determine how efficient and effective the Office of Climate Action, Sustainability, and Resiliency's processes are for monitoring and budgeting the Climate Protection Fund and communicating the Office's performance to the public. For the scope of the audit, we reviewed how well the Climate Action Office is achieving its goals for the voter-initiated Climate Protection Fund and how well it is complying with fund use requirements. This included analyzing outputs and outcomes for fund spending. We reviewed data and documentation from January 2021 through June 30, 2024. I would now like to pause for any questions or comments from the agency and audit committee members.
Questions, comments?
No, not at this time.
Thank you.
I have one.
Okay.
Could someone provide me with a lay definition of what exactly greenhouse gas is and how we measure it?
Sure, absolutely. Well, greenhouse gases are those emissions that come from things like burning gas to drive your car or burning coal in a power plant. Those gases are emitted into the atmosphere and they cause warming. We measure that through a tool that's called a global protocol for community-based greenhouse gas reporting. It's used by cities all across the world. We've actually been globally disclosing our greenhouse gas emissions data for many, many years now, and through something called the Carbon Disclosure Project. And that information is gathered from a variety of sources. So one of the sources of information is Xcel Energy provides what's called a community energy report for every community in Colorado in their service territory that's 50,000 residents or greater. It provides information on the number of electric customers, natural gas customers, how much is used and how much emissions comes from that. We also gather data from other sources like fuel sales, and many other sources, and it goes into this inventory where we calculate our emissions on an annual basis in the city.
So it's based on consumption of the gas, not necessarily what's at any one point in time in the air.
Right.
I had kind of envisioned a little box at Colorado in Colfax. And, you know,
we don't do direct air monitoring. No, we're not doing direct air monitoring. It's using data points to model or analyze how much emissions would be generated within our entire community using a specific methodology. And then there's also methodologies that look at upstream emissions from consumption too. It's harder to do at a local level, but this is called a production-based inventory, and it looks at the emissions that come from the electricity that we all use, you know, in our buildings, all the gas that we use in our buildings, all the vehicles that are driving around on our roads, how much fuel is that using? So it's kind of a methodology that pulls all those data sources together and measures that on an annual basis.
But the answer is implied, not actually what...
Right, we're not going out and actually monitoring in the air.
Yeah. Okay, so then my follow-up question to that is the implication of this then that there will be no gas-based cars in Denver in 2040?
That is
zero, then that's...
Yeah, so the ordinance that created the office indicates as one of the key objectives in the ordinance in the office mission that we should set targets that are based on climate science. And so we worked with some consultants to look at how do we set a science-based target in the city. And because we're a higher emitting community, we have pretty aggressive targets. So 65% reduction by 2030 and net zero emissions by 2040. So yes, we would try to get as close as we could to having zero emissions, including, you know, cars that are electric, et cetera, rather than gas-based.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Brian.
Since we're talking about the broader, before we get into this, greenhouse gases don't follow municipally drawn borders. So does your agency work in the regional with Aurora, Englewood, other municipalities? Are they leading like Denver is?
Yes, we actually worked hand in glove with a number of municipalities as well as the Denver Regional Council of Governments. We did the first regional climate action plan over the last year and a half, 2 years for the entire Dr. Cog area. That was part of a planning grant that came out of the EPA for regions, the 60 largest regions in the U.S. to do climate action plans. And then actually were awarded, Dr. Cog was awarded $200 million to address greenhouse gas emissions in the region. And we have a steering committee that's made up of community members or representatives from all of those communities in the region. So we've been working actually regionally for a really long time, and there's a lot of leaders in the state of Colorado, and the state is also a leader in this space. We coordinate a lot with the state as well.
Okay, let's continue.
Our first finding begins on page 5 of the report. Low staffing levels and informal processes make program monitoring less effective. The office must request and receive approval for positions from the Position Review Committee, which oversees the decision-making process for filling vacant positions. The committee consists of the Department of Finance, the Mayor's Office, and the Office of Human Resources. As shown in Figure 3 on page 6 of the report, the office had about $40 million in unspent Climate Protection Fund dollars, with two positions filled for by the fund in 2021. By 2024, unspent funds were about $6.4 million, with 45 total positions filled. The Climate Action Office has consistently been denied requested staffing positions by the Position Review Committee, with no explanation provided. In addition, the office was unable to meet with the Department of Finance leaders to discuss staffing needs as requested by the committee, despite the Climate Action Office's multiple attempts to set up a meeting. Because of this, the office has not been able to stay sufficiently staffed to keep pace with its growing number of programs. We also reviewed the office's staffing plan and found while it includes many necessary elements of a staffing plan, it was missing some important elements, such as assessing gaps and analyzing risks between the current and future states of its workforce, defining roles, responsibilities, and expectations for staffing, and developing, implementing, and evaluating a workforce action plan, identifying overall progress and improvements needed. I would now like to pause for any questions or comments from the agency, not many members.
Any comments, any questions?
Dan will now present our first sub-finding.
All right, Dan.
Thanks, June. Sub-finding one of finding one begins on page 7 of the report. It states that project managers do not consistently monitor contracts to ensure all costs are supported and allowable. As June mentioned, the Climate Protection Fund and the Capital Projects Fund have provided funding for 114 contracts. For the contracts owned by the Climate Action Office, each is overseen by a project manager within the office. Project managers are responsible for things like vendor relations, tracking deliverables, and monitoring the overall progress of each project. We reviewed invoices from the office's three highest dollar value contracts. The first contract was with McKinstry Ascension LLC for the construction of electric vehicle charging stations and solar panel arrays around the city. The second contract was with Acton Environmental and Infrastructure LLC for the administration of two rebate programs, one for home energy upgrades like heat pumps and rooftop solar panels, and another for electric bike vouchers. And the third contract was with Michaels Energy Inc. for the administration of a rebate program for electrification incentives for both commercial and residential buildings. We randomly sampled 10 invoices from each contract for review. In general, we found issues in two areas. The first related to inadequately documented expenses. For example, we found two of the 30 invoices tested included unallowable expenses, such as meals, mileage, and parking, totaling $418. We also found 5 invoices lacked adequate documentation to support all the expenses on those invoices, and one invoice contained an expense that was incorrectly labeled, although the payment amount for that expense was correct. The second issue found was related to non-compliance with office policies. We were only able to test 20 of the invoices against the office's policy because 10 invoices were received prior to the policy becoming effective. The policy requires staff to include check marks and a text box on each invoice to show the invoice was reviewed. Of the 20 eligible invoices, we found that 14 did not contain check marks and 8 did not contain a review text box. Policy also requires that staff update an invoice's date if the vendor has to resubmit the invoice, but we found that 3 invoices were not updated after resubmission. As June described, the office lacks sufficient staff to perform consistent contract monitoring. However, staff told us that invoice review has historically been problematic, and a position that would assist with dual reviewing invoices was denied by the Position Review Committee in April 2024. In addition to staffing issues, the office's policies for contract monitoring were either insufficient or non-existent, and not all staff were aware of the policies that do exist. The office's invoice review guide does not contain guidance on supporting documentation, and none of the project managers for the contracts tested were aware of the policy's existence. The office also does not have guidance for project managers in areas like suggested type and frequency of monitoring, how to track project deliverables, or resolving issues with vendors. These issues may limit the office's ability to ensure that it is effectively spending money from the Climate Protection Fund in alignment with the ordinance's allowable uses, current and future contracts, or the intent of Denver voters. We have 3 recommendations related to this subfinding and the information presented by June. Beginning on page 9 of the report, recommendation 1.1 states the Office of Climate Action, Sustainability, and Resiliency should revise its existing staffing and hiring plan to determine its staffing needs to meet program objectives and goals. The plan should outline steps to be taken for completing the assessment, give details for the roles and responsibilities of requested positions, and show how staffing gaps will be addressed. The office agreed with this recommendation with an implementation date of September 15, 2025. Recommendation 1.2 states that Climate Action should update its invoice review process guidance to include information on retaining supporting documentation. The office should also ensure that all project managers are trained on documentation retention requirements. The office agreed with this recommendation with an implementation date of August 29, 2025. And recommendation 1.3 states that Climate Action should develop and document policies and procedures for contract monitoring and ensure that all project managers are trained on it. The office agreed with this recommendation with an implementation date of August 29, 2025. I'll now pause for questions and comments from the agency and audit committee members.
Any comments from the agency?
I just wanted to share that we've already begun the process of responding to these recommendations, and we feel confident that we'll be able to implement the outcomes from those processes by the deadline that we provided to you.
Great, thank you. Florine?
So I understand that this is a relatively new office agency. But it's surprising to me that there isn't some sort of procedural process template that would be given to a new agency or office about procedures for invoices, contract management, that sort of thing. Shouldn't that be something that the city develops and then when there's and it be standardized across agencies?
Well, I would agree that it should be done, but I know it's not done. I mean, we've seen this with other dedicated revenue streams for programs that don't have that framework to start with.
So. Yeah, maybe that ought to be a recommendation to the Department of Finance or the mayor's office to develop some sort of standardization that would, like, here's your book. Now you exist. Here, you do this.
I'm in agreement. But other questions? Let's continue.
Thanks, Dan. So finding 2 or finding 1 begins on page 11 of the report. It states that LIOMOU teams do not have a comprehensive performance monitoring process. A review of the Climate Action Office's performance monitoring process found that the office lacks a comprehensive and formal process to monitor and track the performance of its programs. Each LIOMOU team approve either some performance or tracking data, goals, and metrics. Report a process to monitor and track performance, deferred, and lack standardized guidance. Specifically, the process lacks documented policies and procedures for monitoring and evaluation, including data collection methods and frequency of assessments. Established goals, objectives, and key performance indicators of monitoring objectives, and a model to evaluate and analyze inputs, outputs, and outcomes in both the long and short term. If you performance monitoring data for three allowable use teams, including the mobility and energy transition, a green workforce, and adaptation and resiliency team, you found several discrepancies in data, such as a blank fields in mobility and energy transition teams data, including due dates for all programs and progress on reaching its goals for some programs. I mean, participants data for the green workforce teams, job training programs, and incomplete program goals and metrics for the climate action adaptation and resiliency team to track project progress. As discussed on page 13 of the report, staffing constraints affect our office's ability to deliver on projects and monitor performance properly. Adequate staffing would allow our office to frequently track and monitor our program performance, expand the scope of performance tracking activities, and improve the documentation of performance monitoring procedures. Without a robust process for monitoring and tracking program performance, the Climate Action Office cannot guarantee the climate protection funds programs are achieving their goals or the intent of Denver voters. We have four recommendations related to this finding, and our agency agree with all four recommendations with implementation dates of September 15, 2025. Beginning on page 14 of the report, recommendation 1.4 states that the Climate Action Office should develop and document clear objectives, key performance indicators, and measurable goals. Recommendation 1.5 states that the office should develop and document a monitoring plan for its programs and projects, outlining a monitoring process, a data collection, and the frequency of assessments. Recommendation 1.6 states that our office should develop policies and procedures for documenting each program's inputs, outputs, program activities, and outcomes. Finally, recommendation 1.7 states that our office should develop and document an action plan to respond to and improve issues identified in performance evaluations. I will now pause for questions and comments from the agency and other community members before passing it over to Sean to present finding two.
Comments?
Yes, thank you. On this topic of performance monitoring and evaluation, obviously the impact of the funds towards the objectives is really critical. And Our agency has a lot of data and metrics that we monitor and measure. We have a really, really robust greenhouse gas emissions inventory and tracking for that. I know the team saw that when you were doing your work. We really appreciate these findings, and we're going to continue to improve in this area, along with the addition of an additional team member whose job will be focused on kind of creating that consistent framework across the agency. I will say that different programs will always have different key metrics and performance indicators because they have different outcomes they're driving towards. Some of our programs are driving towards reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Others are driving towards how do we increase resilience and our adaptive capacity to climate stressors like extreme heat. So there will be different kind of key performance indicators for different teams and programs, but creating that consistent framework and monitoring across the agency is critical.
Great. Questions from the committee? All right.
Hi. Thank you, Frank. Finding two begins on page 16 of the report, and it states projects funded for other Denver agencies did not always align with the ordinances, allowable uses, and the office's mission and goals. Climate Action leaders of the Budget and Management Office sometimes advocate for the office to fund other agencies' projects with the Climate Protection Fund. Budget and Management requested the office to fund four positions in community planning and development after the department expressed the need for those positions to the previous mayor. As a result, Climate Action agreed to fund the positions, but office leaders did not want to fund the inspector positions because they do not align with the fund's intended outcomes. These positions also do not align with the office's mission to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Additionally, Community Planning and Development used Climate Protection Fund money to pay for two positions that were not involved in climate-related work without reporting it to the office. The department was able to misuse Climate Protection Fund money because the Climate Action Office does not have a formal, documented process for monitoring projects it funds for other city agencies. Budget Management also requested the Climate Action Office to fund $6 million of the Department of Transportation and Infrastructure's Colfax Bus Rapid Transit Program. Office staff said the project's greenhouse gas reduction benefits do not justify the $6 million committed to the project. As of June 2024, none of this money had been spent, meaning Climate Action could not use those funds on other projects that would have a more immediate impact on greenhouse gas emissions. Finally, the Budget and Management Office requested the office pay $4.6 million to electrify the city's fleet vehicles because it was one of the mayor's priorities in the 2025 budget. Before the request, Climate Action's internal policy did not allow the Climate Protection Fund to pay for city fleet vehicles because of concerns with the way the city's vehicle fleet was managed, and they wanted to ensure electric vehicles would replace existing gas-powered vehicles. These projects and positions were funded because the office does not have formal rules and regulations outlining the process for the Climate Protection Fund to pay for other agencies' projects, or what the office should consider when determining whether to fund a project. While the office has an allowable use policy and their five-year plan, the policies are not established in formal city rules, and other city agencies do not consider the office's internal policies as binding. Beginning on page 20 of the report, we found the Climate Action Office and the Budget and Management Office have different definitions of supplanting, or replacing Climate Protection Fund money with general fund money. The Climate Protection Fund ordinance says its money may not replace nor supplant any general fund appropriations allocated each year to the Climate Action Office. However, the ordinance is unclear on whether the fund can replace other agencies' money from the general fund. While the ordinance specifies climate funds cannot replace general fund money allocated to the office, it does not place the same restriction on other city agencies. The Climate Action Office recommended Budget and Management keep the fund additive to prevent it from becoming a substitute for other agencies' projects. Budget and Management said that while the Climate Action Office was correct that the fund was meant to be in addition to the general fund, the legal language gives the city the opportunity to adjust how climate initiatives are funded each year. These different interpretations happened because the Climate Action Office has not received documented guidance on supplanting from Budget and Management despite several requests for guidance. While managers in Budget and Management said they received supplanting guidance from the City Attorney's Office, they were unable to find and provide that guidance to us. Budget and Management also said the supplanting definitions in the fund's ordinance and the city's fiscal rules aligned with each other. However, we found they do not fully align. While the climate ordinance specifies that planting cannot take place for funds allocated each year, the fiscal rule does not specify that supplanting only applies within the same budget year. On page 29 of the report, we found the Climate Action Office's expenses to other city agencies cannot be independently verified. The office said it spent over $14 million on projects and positions for other city agencies from January 2021 through June 2024, but we could not verify whether that was accurate. While the office tracks six expenses in a spreadsheet and internal dashboard, they have several limitations making determining total costs to city agencies difficult, including personnel costs for funded positions in other city agencies being combined with the office's own personnel costs, not all agreements with other city agencies were included in the dashboard, and inconsistent names for the same city agencies. Despite this, we tried to confirm the office's spending on other city agencies ourselves. However, we were unable to determine expenses for other agencies because we would need to know the specific purchase orders used, past and present employees to filter out unwanted expenses, spent versus committed funds to another city agency, personnel and payroll costs received in reports from the Department of Finance. Additionally, climate actions, policies, and procedures do not say how the office determines its expenses to other city agencies. Therefore, beginning on page 22 of the report, we provide five recommendations. Recommendation 2.1 states, the Office of Climate Action, Sustainability, and Resiliency should develop and document formal rules and regulations for what it considers when making funding decisions and the process for making funding decisions for other city agencies. The office agreed with this recommendation with an implementation date of November 18th, 2025. Recommendation 2.2 states the office should document and implement a process to monitor other city agencies' projects funded by the Climate Protection Fund to ensure funds are used in alignment with the ordinance's allowable uses and interagency agreements. The office agreed with this recommendation with an implementation date of August 29th, 2025. And recommendation 2.3 states, as part of implementing recommendation 2.2, the office should document and implement a process to retain supporting documentation of its funding decisions and expenses to other city agencies in alignment with the city's general records retention schedule. The office agreed with this recommendation with an implementation date of July 31st, 2025. Recommendation 2.4 states, the office should work with the city attorney's office and the budget and management office to develop and document formal guidance on what is and is not considered supplanting for the Climate Protection Fund. Once this guidance is documented, the office should document and implement policies and procedures to monitor programs to ensure supplanting does not occur. The office agreed with this recommendation with an implementation date of September 30th, 2025. And finally, recommendation 2.5 states, the office should develop, document, and implement a method to track Climate Protection Fund spending on other city agencies' programs, such as using program codes in Workday. The office agreed with this recommendation with an implementation date of July 31st, 2025. Pause for any questions or comments.
Comments? No comments on this one, Jack?
Well, I've got a question, and maybe I'm confused, but it seems that there, and please explain to me if that's not the case, but given what your findings are, it seems that there may be somebody missing from the table from the budget office. In other words, you've raised a bunch of issues that relate to the general fund and the budget, and I'm a little at a loss, and it may be my problem, as to how one can expect this department to do all the things that you've recommended unless the budget office works with them to define what they've got to do. Am I missing something here? I'm just trying to understand.
No, I think you're exactly right. A lot of these recommendations do require participation from the budget and management office. Being that, you know, we only audited the Climate Action Office and only entered with them, our recommendations are really set in place to a both encourage that conversation, hopefully to bring kind of both parties to the table to kind of hash it out.
So I would like to respond to that as well. We are working closely with the Budget Management Office to follow through on this recommendation, and I'm sure we will be able to get to a place of more clarity, because it doesn't only affect our agency and our office, and I think that's part of the conversation here, is that it's bigger than just this particular fund in our office.
Yet previous and prior discussions with the Budget Office, they wouldn't reply to you about why the Position Review Committee wouldn't increase some of the positions you requested.
We did get responses from the Position Review Committee that were high-level responses, so more general responses about considering these positions as potential reductions for future.
So, I mean, you have a mandate from the voters to create this, to do this work, and it comes with a revenue stream, and you staffed up, you know, from 2021 till today. You were denied positions that you felt you needed to accomplish the mandate, the objectives of the fund. And yet we're spending $14 million on things that really aren't related to the Climate Protection Fund. Is this like an end run on the whole budget process?
I would characterize the spending as not related to the Climate Protection Fund is not quite right. I think what we were talking about was which things are the highest and best use. So our Sustainability Advisory Council, some of our team felt that, for example, if you're looking at how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, you can immediately do things like incentivize electrification of vehicles. That has an immediate impact on greenhouse gas emissions. Obviously, mode shift is really important, and so funding Colfax BRT is actually a really important long-term strategy, but I think there was a disagreement among people who are experts in this field about the highest and best use of those funds. So I wouldn't characterize it as they're not allowable or they're not tied, but perhaps not the most impactful way to spend that particular set of dollars towards the outcome in the fund. Likewise with the positions, there was a switch of which positions were being paid for, and so it was unclear to us what the work that was done, you know, by those positions. But they were originally intended to be positions that were tied to having an impact, which would be on the energy codes in the city. So having to do with new construction and energy codes that actually draw down emissions. But there was some change in the way the accounting was done, and that was not shared with us initially. And so that was where some of that came in. But I would say that in general, the dollars were spent towards things that are allowable and are connected, but perhaps not the highest and best use of dollars.
Okay. So how do you fix it? I mean, you know, it's like a lot of times, you know, I may be guilty of saying things aren't being done and why not. And here you're doing what I think is a really great job of identifying some real problems. So I guess my question would be if you had the power, what is it that you think needs to be done to solve the question of the highest and best use of taxpayers' money?
Yeah.
And it's just, you're caught in between. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah.
If I may.
Absolutely. I mean, I will say that in general, when you look at the fund, there's seven different allowable uses. One is administration, and the remaining are on the impact and the outcome that you're driving towards the fund. You can have debates with experts in these fields and come up with varying, you know, answers on what is the highest and best use of these dollars. So there, I don't think there is one answer to that question. But what I think would be helpful is some of the recommendations in here, which is documenting the formal policies and procedures, rules and regulations, so that there's at least agreement that this is the playing field. This is the way that we're making decisions. This is how dollars are getting prioritized. And then if that needs to change because perhaps there's new scientific information, there's new data, maybe there's new inputs from the community as we go out to the community and talk about priorities. Maybe we have more balance of the funding going towards adaptation and resilience work, for example. Then we would formally update those. And that would be something that would be very transparent and very clear about how those decisions would change in the future based on those criteria that we would set.
But please correct me if I'm wrong. You're dependent on a number of other players and organizations in order to do what you need to do. And is that right?
Do you mean internal or external? I'm not sure which organizations are...
You know, like you were saying, I'm just going to pick this one only because we've been talking about it, is, you know, the Colfax bus project. And there are other agencies involved, namely RTD and whoever's doing all the construction and everything else there. And I am assuming, and I may be wrong about this from what you're saying, that these other parties and organizations have a major impact on how well that money gets spent. Am I wrong? I'm just trying not, you know, I'm just listening to, you know, things are a problem, but I guess the question is, how do we go about fixing it?
So what I would say is that the money will be well spent on the Colfax BRT. I think, just to be very clear, we're very supportive of that project. Multimodal transportation is clearly an important climate strategy. I think the question about that funding specifically was, should you spend it on that, which the greenhouse gas emissions impact from that will be longer term and not as easy to measure, versus should you spend that on something that is a more near-term, immediate reduction in greenhouse gas emissions using those dollars. And I think that was some of the debate that we had with our Sustainability Advisory Council when they found out about this funding. And so I think that there is a discussion to be had about if we're funding anything, what are the criteria by which we are deciding that that funding is the best way to achieve the outcome? And I think that is really more of the issue here. Not so much are they spending the dollars well or not well. I mean, the projects will be completed. Dottie is heavily involved, and I think the project is an excellent project to do for many reasons, including climate. But I think the question is just, you know, would you spend $6 million there, or would you spend it elsewhere to reduce emissions through another way that would be maybe more immediate or more impactful?
So who makes those decisions?
Well, I think that's, you know, what the findings are showing here is that we need a more formalized set. We do have an internal policy here. But we do need a more sort of formalized set of rules to ensure that those decisions are informed by the climate science as well as community input in terms of how they're made.
Did the advisory group weigh in on the bus BRT?
I think there was discussions afterwards because we usually do a presentation. The advisory council does not have authority over budget. That's not a formal authority that they have, but we do like to be transparent. I think you found in the report that we have a really good transparency when it comes to reporting out to the community what we're doing with the funding. So we do, you know, provide presentations to those committees on what's going on. And so that was part of a presentation at one point in time in the past, and I think there was some debate on the committee about that.
Well, I'm trying to get to, did they say this is a good idea, or we would rather you do something different?
It was mixed, but I think there was definitely a strong group of folks who felt that that was not the highest and best use towards reducing emissions in the immediate term.
Right. And highest and best use could be immediate or long term, and that needs to be defined also.
Correct.
In the rules?
Correct.
Is there a rulemaking going on today?
Today? Not today, as far as I'm aware. That is one of the recommendations that we agreed with in here, so we will be looking at that.
But who's got the bottom line responsibility? Is that the mayor, ultimately?
This is a department of the mayor's office.
Yeah. So
it's not an independent organization.
Yeah.
they have rules to follow and the committee guides them, but it's still his department.
Some of the building inspectors funded have nothing to do with climate change.
The four positions originally funded in CPD were all connected. Then when the accounting changed, two of the positions that were being funded were not connected. So the inspectors had to do with inspecting the energy code, which is very complex and it changes every time we update the code. So it's actually really important that things in the real world as built actually reflect what the design is. And so if you are building something that actually doesn't align with the code, we're not getting those energy savings and greenhouse gas savings. So I think two positions were focused more on the code development side, and then two positions were more on the inspector side, and then there was an accounting change that occurred that allocated the funding to other positions that were not tied to that.
Other questions?
All right, thank you, Sean. Finding three begins on page 25. It says the Climate Protection Fund's budget process is not sufficiently researched and supported by data. Without a well-researched or data-driven budgeting process for the Climate Protection Fund, Climate Action's ability to allocate its resources efficiently is limited, which can impact its ability in achieving the fund's goals. Currently, Climate Action uses a percentage-based budgeting method that divides the Climate Protection Fund's money into specific allowable use categories, with each category assigned a fixed percentage of the total funds. When asked, manager said percentage-based budgeting may not be the most effective way of allocating the Climate Protection Fund's resources, since many projects span multiple allowable use categories and do not fit into a single classification. As seen in figure 4 on page 25, over $91.4 million, or 87% of the Climate Protection Fund's money was used towards contracts that spanned multiple allowable use categories. Furthermore, 38 of the 103 total Climate Protection Fund contracts involved two or more allowable uses. For the Climate Capital Fund, 99% of funds were used for contracts involving multiple allowable uses, with 7 of the 11 contracts including multiple allowable use categories. Office leader said that during the initial stages of the Climate Protection Fund, a budgeting approach was chosen based on estimates and broad goals rather than specific research and data due to time constraints and limited data availability. Without conducting an assessment on its budgeting method, the Climate Action Office risks missing opportunities to achieve the Climate Protection Fund's goals effectively and maximizing its overall impact. Therefore, we have two recommendations beginning on page 26. Recommendation 3.1 states the Office of Climate Action, Sustainability, and Resiliency should conduct and document an evaluation of its budgeting process for the Climate Protection Fund to explore whether its budgeting method or alternative methods best suit its needs. This evaluation should document the data and information used to evaluate budgeting methods. The Office agreed with this recommendation with an implementation date of September 15, 2025. Recommendation 3.2 states, after completing Recommendation 3.1, the Office of Climate Action, Sustainability, and Resiliency should implement its desired budgeting method and document it in formal policies and procedures. The Office agreed with this recommendation with an implementation date of September 15, 2025. This concludes our presentation. We thank you for your time and would like to open the floor for any questions or comments from the Office of Climate Action, Sustainability, and Resiliency and Audit Committee members.
Any comments?
I would just say on this one, you know, we've known from the early days of the fund creation that, you know, the purposes in the allowable use category weren't necessarily written to be accounting language. So, you know, you can say I bought a solar panel and it cost this much, right? But you can't say, you know, I spent $5 on resilience. What does that mean, right? So we have cost centers that were tied to the six allowable uses of the original ordinance language from the ballot. And what we have tried to do over the years is make sure that every project that we're doing has as much impact towards the outcomes of the fund as possible. So if we're doing one single project, we want to make sure that you know, we're reducing greenhouse gas emissions and we're also building resilience at the same time. We're incorporating green workforce and apprenticeship programs into that. We're doing, you know, environmental and climate justice as part of that project. So the outcome and the intent and the impact that was intended from the language of the ballot measure and the accounting, I think, has just become challenging to kind of square those up because, again, you know, when you say you've bought $5 of climate justice, what does that mean, right? Versus I bought a solar panel or I bought a battery. So I think that we have some work to do just to square that to make sure that we can do the accounting well, but we also are thinking holistically about the outcomes that we want to achieve with the projects that we're funding.
Thank you. I have another question. You have a 66 staff, or have you increased the staff?
I believe we have 68.
In the CPF?
Yeah.
44.
In the Climate Protection Fund.
I'm sorry.
We have in the office overall, I believe we have 68 staff. In the Climate Protection Fund, we have 44.
Filled currently.
Yes. 44 filled, yeah.
And your turnover? Do you have a turnover rate among those staff?
I don't know that I've seen the turnover rate recently. We have historically had a pretty low turnover rate in the agency.
So they're really mission-focused people then?
Yes.
You know, earlier this morning we had an audit on organizational culture, and I just wondered, you know, having some of the dollars redirected the way they were, what impact does that have on morale in your organization?
I'm not sure that, you know, we've had really negative impacts on morale from that specifically. I think as a new organization in the city, to your point, we are very mission driven. We attract a lot of people who are very passionate about the work. We've also been kind of a startup. And so I think some of the challenges identified in this audit are things that our staff would also echo around, you know, formalizing policies and procedures, having more standard practices in place. So on the one hand, I think people, we have a really motivated team because they're doing work that they really enjoy and they see the impact every day in the community. And on the other hand, the frustrations of kind of some of the internal documentation of policies and practices and just how things get done is challenging. And so, you know, improvement in that area, I think, will be very helpful for the team.
Okay. Yes?
I know we're almost done, but now I have a question. 44 positions in the Climate Action Fund, is that how many are approved or how many filled?
Filled.
Okay, how many are approved?
Do you have the FTE 60. Count just for the fund?
Yeah, total 60.
60 for the fund.
Okay, and 66 in the whole department?
Filled.
How many?
60, I think it's 68
how many general
in the department?
Fund positions?
I think it's 68 in the department, filled.
Okay, so the rest are general fund positions?
Correct.
So when they
and
talk
one bag fee fund, we have one other fund.
When they talk about positions that aren't getting approved by the committee, were we talking only about climate protection fund positions, or are they not approving general fund positions?
The audit was only for the climate protection funds.
So no general fund positions in that analysis of not getting approved. When they talk about reductions, you mentioned reductions, they're saying hold these for reductions.
We had climate protection fund positions that we were told to hold for reductions.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. The next item is general business. Our next committee meeting will be here Thursday, June 26th at 9 a.m. in the Parker Widener room. With that, I'm going to ask that we adjourn to executive session to talk with our independent auditors. It's an audit in process, so I think it's appropriate that we do this in executive session.
Auditors.
Is there a motion to go into executive session?
I so moved.
Thank you.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor? Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. We're in executive session.
The Independent Audit Committee was established by charter and receives audit reports and other information from the Denver Audit Office. The committee strives to bring greater clarity, transparency, and accountability to Denver's city government and its residents. It is also responsible for commissioning an annual audit of the city's annual comprehensive financial report. This committee is chaired by Auditor Timothy M. O'Brien.
Would you take the roll?
Of course. Jack Blumenthal.
Here.
Maureen Knapp.
Here.
Ed Schultz.
Here.
Frank Groh.
Here.
Tim O'Brien.
Here. Next item is approval of the April meeting minutes. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
Second. Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, the minutes are approved. Next item we have is a report briefing on organizational culture. I'd like to welcome LaTanya from the mayor's office, at least for a little while longer. Is that right?
Indeed. Good morning, everyone.
Carly Anthony from Human Resources, Gretchen Hollera from Arts and Venues, and Jolyn Clark from Parks and Recreation. Doris, would you like to introduce